Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes three times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
People in the Gaza Strip are struggling just to get by as deliveries of humanitarian aid have slowed way down.
Everyone is worried about starvation. Everyone is worried, of course, about disease.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll also dive into this week's elections in the holy city of Jerusalem and illegal mining operations that are depleting global supplies of sand.
It goes beyond what we can imagine once we're there.
Plus, some students in Minnesota are getting a taste of the globe in their cafeteria at lunch.
This is fufu. Fufu is like in almost like every African country, and they all kind of like make it a different way. My mom, she's made it with peanut sauce and chicken, spinach, tomatoes, onions.
Dispelling some myths and serving up African cuisine.
All those stories and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. A top Palestinian official in the West Bank announced his resignation today. Mohammed Shtaya was the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, which is backed by the U.S. Shtaya said new political arrangements are needed. His resignation appears to be a move toward possible reforms of the Palestinian Authority, something the Biden administration has been calling for. Shtaya also said that what's happening in Gaza is, quote, genocide, and he condemned what he called Israeli escalation in the West Bank. The president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, reportedly accepted the prime minister's resignation.
As those political moves are playing out today in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, more than 2 million Palestinian civilians continue to face perilous conditions. On Sunday, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said he hopes a ceasefire deal can be reached in the coming days. That could see the release of remaining Israeli hostages in Gaza and a boost in humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Israeli leaders say they're still moving ahead with plans to forcibly evacuate people from the southern Gaza city of Rafah and then send in Israeli forces to attack Hamas battalions there.
That day-to-day reality inside Gaza continues to alarm aid agencies. The United Nations says it's no longer able to run humanitarian aid operations in the territory. In recent days, the number of relief trucks getting into Gaza has dwindled to a fraction of what it was before the war. Those vehicles have also been attacked by crowds of desperate and hungry people. Shayna Lowe is with the Norwegian Refugee Council in Jerusalem, and she says the situation in northern Gaza is especially bad.
I do believe that some food has gotten in. Overall, very, very little is getting up there. If there is stuff that's available on the black market, the cost is prohibitive to most people who have been facing more than 140 days of this escalation. And what we're hearing from our staff, a handful of whom have remained in northern Gaza and Gaza City, is that they've run out of flour, they've run out of corn, they've run out of oil, and basically are running out of animal fodder, which is what they've had to resort to eating because there just simply is not food available in any significant quantity. There was a report last week from the WFP that in northern Gaza, 15.6% of children aged 2 and under are exhibiting signs of acute malnutrition. This is more than 16 times the number found in Gaza prior to October 7th.
And what about in the south, where there are some 1.5 million Palestinians crowded into Rafah? What's the food situation there?
There is still some food available. Some of it is getting in on these handful of aid trucks that are still managing to make it in. A trickle of the 200 trucks per day that Israel had committed itself to. But the food that's available on the commercial market has had the cost massively inflated. So 30 eggs, you used to be able to get them for 9 shekels, which is a little bit over $2, $2.50. That cost is now somewhere around 100 shekels, so closer to $30 for 30 eggs, which for most people, they just simply can't afford. The cost of other staples has just skyrocketed. And most people cannot afford to purchase food. They're reliant on aid, and the trickle of aid is nowhere near enough.
UNRWA, the UN agency, had been coordinating and facilitating most, if not all, aid into Gaza Strip. Why have they had to stop operations?
UNRWA was relying on Palestinian police officers. These are civil servants, many of whom are not affiliated or even members of the Fatah party. And they were relying on these police officers to accompany and escort aid as it was being brought in and brought to distribution points, particularly food aid. But Israel was using the aid distributions as an opportunity to target police officers, typically right after the aid had been distributed or delivered. And so there were a number of direct attacks on targeting of Palestinian police in Gaza, which has now led the police to say that they are unwilling to support aid agencies in distributions. And as a result, we've seen an increase in looting, and not just of people going and taking food off of trucks, but actually violence towards truck drivers trying to bring aid into Gaza and to reach people in need.
There have been some airdrops of aid into different areas of Gaza. How effective is that as a method for getting folks in Gaza what they need?
Of course, any aid is needed and useful. But in terms of the impact that they're able to make, it's really just a drop in the ocean. The real issue is not about the need for airdrops, but it's the need to be able to access all parts of Gaza and to guarantee the safety of humanitarians. There are means of getting aid into Gaza. The Kerem Shalom crossing was operational prior to October 7th. It's been operational for the last couple of months, but it's not operating anywhere near capacity.
So what is behind the Kerem Shalom crossing not being fully operational?
Logistically, it is taking too long, and they have the capacity and the means to do screenings much faster than they are under these circumstances. And then on top of that, we've seen over the last few weeks Israeli civilians protesting and blocking the entry of aid. And Israel has an obligation under international law as the occupying power to provide for the basic needs for the survival of the civilian population. Rather than to stop these protests and get the aid in, they're allowing a few dozen Israeli civilians to block aid from getting in. And there were a couple of days last week where fewer than 10 aid trucks were entering Gaza, and some days where no aid was entering through Kerem Shalom crossing.
I know that you're in touch with colleagues who are in Gaza. What are their fears about what happens if nothing changes here?
I mean, everyone is worried about starvation. Everyone is worried, of course, about disease. We've seen the spread of disease continue to grow. You have people who have been living either in very close quarters in collective shelters. You have people who are sleeping in tents or outside exposed to the elements. We've already seen at least around 30,000 reported killed as a result of the hostilities. But we're worried that the longer that this goes on, not only will the death toll rise as a direct result of hostilities, but also indirect deaths as a result of starvation and preventable or treatable illnesses that people just simply cannot overcome.
That's Shayna Lowe with the Norwegian Refugee Council based in Jerusalem. Ahead this hour, we go back to Jerusalem, where the war hangs heavy over tomorrow's local elections.
North Korea is one of the most heavily sanctioned countries on earth. In order to punish Pyongyang for making nuclear weapons, the United Nations, along with the U.S. and other countries, severely limit what North Korea can sell globally. But North Korea is now churning out a product that U.N. sanctions overlooked. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, a country's hottest export is probably not what you'd expect.
Most companies wouldn't boast that its products are made in North Korea, but I found one that does. It's a wholesaler of wigs made with human hair. The company, G Hair, posts videos on Facebook showing off the different styles and lengths.
10-inch, 12-inch, and 40-inch. If you're interested, please feel free to contact us.
I did contact the company. It's in Guangzhou, China, not far from Hong Kong. A sales rep, who told me to call her Janice, hopped on a video call to show off her warehouse, full of luscious, shiny wigs. They attach to the scalp with a sheer lace cap. I asked Janice where these products are made.
Yes, the lace product made in North Korea.
The actual hair, that was grown on human heads in Myanmar or China, she says. It's then shipped to North Korea, made into wigs, and shipped back to China.
Yeah, made in the North Korea. But the North Korea will have a longer time to make it.
The longer wait time may be worth it. In China's human hair industry, the largest in the world, North Koreans are known for their expertise in making wigs. Chinese customs data shows that North Korea's top export is now human hair, nearly $170 million worth of hair in 2023, mostly wigs. Why so many wigs? Well, unlike coal or seafood, two of North Korea's most valuable resources, human hair is not spelled out in international sanctions. North Korea expert Go Myung-hyun says the regime is nothing if not creative.
North Korea has to be creative to find ways to bypass sanctions as well as find loopholes.
Go is with the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in South Korea. He says wigs are a nice loophole for Pyongyang. Under UN sanctions, it is perfectly legal for a Chinese company to buy wigs from North Korea.
As long as the revenue they gain from this export is not diverted to missile and nuclear development, I believe this can continue.
Wig profits might be going into weapons development, Go says, but so far, that's not proven. Not much is known about the working conditions of North Korea's wig makers. Defectors have told an activist group, the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, that some wigs are made by prisoners. But most are made by state-run work units, according to the news outlet Daily NK, which covers North Korea from Seoul. Younger North Koreans are recruited for their sharp eyesight and fine motor skills. It is meticulous work. Troy Stangarone, with the Korea Institute of America, a policy research center, says wig making is attractive to the regime because it requires no machinery or even electricity.
They don't need to bring in equipment from outside. They can tap into their own labor pool and really do this on their own without much sophistication.
While Chinese companies are free to rely on North Korean labor, Americans are not, Stangarone says. Under U.S. law, just about anything passing through North Korea is forbidden, even if the tag on the hairpiece ends up saying made in China.
It is important for those in the United States importing these types of items from China to really inspect their supply chains closely to make sure that they are not importing hair that is processed within North Korea.
The punishment can be severe. In 2019, a California-based cosmetics company called Elf Beauty was hit with nearly $1 million in fines for importing fake eyelash kits from a Chinese company. The U.S. Treasury Department said those lashes were actually assembled in North Korea. Ultimately, it's the American importer's job to avoid this mistake, Stangarone says. Don't expect a foreign company to know U.S. laws. I asked Janice, the human hair exporter in Guangzhou, China, if she ships to the U.S.
Yes, we can ship to America. Normally for 2 to 5 working days can be delivered.
Her North Korean-made wigs do look beautiful. They sell for hundreds of dollars a piece. But anyone caught importing one into the U.S. could wind up paying a much higher price. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
There is space for 120,000 worshippers, a library with 1 million books, and a helicopter pad. I'm talking about the Great Mosque of Algiers that was inaugurated yesterday, the third largest mosque in the world.
A golden dome sits atop a modernist building with Arab and North African influences. The pale stone exterior will be lit up at night. Construction of the ambitious mosque was a symbol of Algeria's strength and religious faith, but years of political upheaval brought cost overruns and delays to the project.
Algeria has made a moderate version of Islam a key priority after the government subdued an Islamist-led rebellion and civil war in the 1990s. The official cost of the mosque's construction, $898 million, stoked anger among Algerians, with many saying they'd rather have new hospitals built across the country. For a few years already, the Great Mosque of Algiers has been welcoming tourists and dignitaries, but its inauguration over the weekend means it can officially open to the public for nightly prayers during Ramadan next month.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. 2023 was the hottest year on record, according to U.S. and European science agencies. The call to cut greenhouse gas pollution has never been louder. As temperatures continue to climb, though, cities and towns around the world are finding ways to adapt. To get a sense of what that looks like in one part of the world, we head to the beach with reporter Stacey Vanek-Smith.
It is winter in Dubai, and Kite Beach is packed. Families are lounging on blankets near the water. A little roped-off section of the Persian Gulf is teeming with swimmers, and the boardwalk is buzzing.
Sorry. Can I get a lemon iced tea, please?
Regular, right?
Yeah.
Sure. It's very good, man.
Thank you
so much.
The only thing missing from this classic beach scene? The sun. Why? Because it is 11 o'clock at night right now, and Kite Beach is just coming to life.
The people, they like come at night.
EJ Eco runs the iced tea stand. He opened at 2 p.m., but he says people don't really start showing up until 7 or 8 p.m., because before then, it's just too hot and humid.
It's just like a terrible hot. You cannot like stay outside. It's gonna be like burn yourself if you're gonna stay outside.
But at 11 p.m., the iced tea stand is hopping. A lot of tourists have shown up, but also some locals, including Dubai resident Karis Magnan.
It's comfortable and the breeze is nice because it's by the water, and it just feels like really relaxed.
It's about 88 degrees right now and still pretty humid.
Would you ever come during the day?
Not now because it's so hot for sure.
Too hot. The temperature at this beach regularly tops 100 degrees. It can be dangerous to be outside. That's part of why the city has created several night beaches, complete with floodlights, lifeguards, food stands, games, and rides. The lifeguards are on duty all night.
We do have to think about adaptation strategies. We really are going to be struggling more and more.
Melissa Finnegan is a behavioral scientist and also the vice president of science and innovation at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She says coastal communities all over the world have been scrambling to find ways to deal with the effects of climate change. In Fiji, resorts have started offering more indoor activities for guests who might need a break from the heat or shelter from storms. The coastal town of Montauk, New York, has created a plan to relocate the entire community inland. And in the Maldives, the government has built an artificial island to make up for land lost to sea level rise. Finnegan says billions of people have already been affected by climate change, and that number is only growing. She says that is why people are starting to come together to find solutions.
These are all human decisions, or they have human impacts, and there are values involved, and they're often really difficult trade-offs. So I think innovation is really going to come from integrating all of these dimensions.
Finnegan says mitigating the effects of climate change is not just an engineering challenge. She says it's important to preserve community and economy in coastal areas.
Social infrastructure, you know, meaning the places where people gather to spend time and build strength as a community, is really important.
Finnegan says what's most important are preventative measures, things like reducing carbon emissions. At the same time, she says, communities do need to find ways to adapt because climate change is already drastically affecting our lives. Back at Kite Beach, Karis Magnan and her friend Ashley Taylor Smith are sipping iced tea and eating bratwurst at a table near the sand. They look out at the Gulf, illuminated by these big floodlights.
So do you think you'll come back to the beach at night?
Definitely. It just feels like really relaxed, and it's comfortable.
You can make a day out of it.
Or a night. For The World, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith, Dubai, United Arab Emirates.
If you walk the halls of John Marshall High School in Rochester, Minnesota, you'll meet students whose families come from all over the world, many of them from several different African countries. But many of the 1,700 students at John Marshall High don't know much about their classmates' backgrounds. This month, several events have been held to change that, starting in the cafeteria. Minnesota Public Radio's Catherine Richard has our story.
It's lunchtime at John Marshall High School, but what's on the menu isn't your basic cafeteria food.
This is fufu. Fufu is like in almost like every African country, and they all kind of like make it a different way. My mom, she's made it with peanut sauce and chicken, spinach, tomatoes, onions, a lot of stuff. Usually it's really spicy, but today she didn't make it very spicy.
Probably a good idea. Right?
Yeah.
That's Senior Adina Campbell. She's serving food from her mother's home country of Togo in West Africa. Dozens of students line up to grab Campbell's fufu along with sambusas and jollof rice from other students. These are dishes found in an array of African countries. Junior Avery Lenz piled her plate with cassava flour flatbread.
A lot of different cultures have amazing foods, and it's awesome to get it to experience new things because you might find something that you is not your new favorite food. This is a great way to show people that you can go out of your comfort zone, try new things.
That's the whole point of the lunch, which is sponsored by members of the Black Student Union. The group planned this meal to counter school programming that they say poorly represents their cultures and traditions, even during February when the school celebrates Black History Month. That's especially true for recent immigrants to America or students who are first generation, says Black Student Union advisor Orlandis White.
And we was like, we wanted more activities and more events that would actually reflect who we are. And let's help dispel some of the myths that people have about Africans and African Americans.
Student Hannah Bakoy, who lived in Ghana and then New York before she came to Rochester, says she's experienced some of those stereotypes.
The kids are poor, you don't live in a house, you have to hunt for your food. Their stereotype, it doesn't have water, it doesn't have this. That's not actually Africa. Africa isn't what you think it is.
Bakoy wants her peers to know that they have these things. It's just different, and she's proud of that. Meanwhile, school equity specialist Rodney Sharp says African and African-American students are sometimes viewed by their white peers as a monolithic group with identical life experiences because of the color of their skin. And that can create its own tension.
A lot of people from the outside just see their skin color, and they see, like, oh, they must be African-American. What a lot of the Africans are like, well, don't take away from our culture and say that we're African-American.
Dispelling stereotypes that white students have about their African peers is one goal of the Black Student Union. Another is helping its group members dismantle stereotypes they have about each other. Abouk Adir is from South Sudan. It's a predominantly Christian country that split from the mostly Muslim northern region of Sudan in 2011, following decades of civil war. Adir says she's had challenging conversations with some members of the Black Student Union who are from Sudan, and she says old stereotypes and misconceptions have come into play. But she says their group kept talking, and students eventually found common ground.
We'd always have long, like, conversations where we'd sit and we'd just talk about the wars, about our families back in the day, the struggles that we have similarly, because both of our families are at home right now. They're both struggling with the floods and the bombing and the war. All of our families, there's a lot of people who are lost from their families. We bond over that and we understand each other. And regardless of our backgrounds or whether where we're from, we're still the same because we're going through the same stuff.
There is one thing, though, that members of the Black Student Union say they may never see eye to eye on, and that's which country has the best food. For The World, I'm Catherine Richer, Rochester, Minnesota.
More global news and stories still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
A group of coal miners from Wales recently traveled to Ukraine to deliver aid to their Ukrainian counterparts in a time of need.
There may be cultural differences, there may be language differences, but at the end of the day, coal miners are coal miners. Those who've worked underground understand exactly what miners in other countries have gone through.
A brotherhood of mine workers and repaying an old favor still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Israel is holding municipal elections tomorrow. People in cities and towns across the country will elect mayors and council members, except perhaps for one group of people, Palestinians living in Jerusalem, who make up about 40% of that city's population. The majority of them are not citizens of Israel. When Israel annexed East Jerusalem in 1967, Palestinian residents were given the right to vote in city elections. Mostly they have chosen to boycott them. But one young Palestinian candidate is trying to change people's minds. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has more from Jerusalem.
I'm in the heart of East Jerusalem, sitting on the terrace of a popular hilltop cafe. 21-year-old Noor Mansour works here. When I ask her if she's planning to vote in Tuesday's municipal elections, she can't help but laugh in my face.
Of course not. They're not for us, you know?
Us is the 362,000 Palestinians living in East Jerusalem. When Israel annexed this territory in 1967, it was unified with West Jerusalem under one municipality. The Palestinians living here weren't offered Israeli citizenship, but they were given a residency status that allows them to vote in local elections. but less than 1% do, for a number of reasons.
I don't think I'm considered as the targeted audience. According to this country, I'm like a third-class citizen, so...
We look at this body, the municipality of Jerusalem, as a body that is belonging to the state that's occupying Palestine, that's making their life harder.
Thirty-three-year-old Ahmad Muna runs this busy coffee and English bookshop near Damascus Gate. He says the majority of Palestinians in East Jerusalem don't have faith in this system because historically it hasn't represented them.
This is the same body that demolishes Palestinian homes. This is the same body that puts checkpoints and stops Palestinians from going from one neighborhood to another, from the West Bank to Jerusalem. This is the same body that does not invest in East Jerusalem's education system or health system.
And perhaps just as importantly, Palestinians in East Jerusalem see a vote in local Israeli elections as an acknowledgement of Israel's control of a place they see as a future capital of a Palestinian state, something most Palestinians wouldn't dare to do. But some residents in East Jerusalem argue nothing's going to change unless they work from the inside, as one of the city council's 31 members. Sundus Al-Hut is a bold 33-year-old looking to become the first Arab to win a seat on Jerusalem's city council. Al-Hut, who is part of an Arab-Jewish alliance party called Kol Toshaveha, or All Its Residents, says she is all too familiar with the discrimination Arabs in Jerusalem face. Despite Palestinians making up 40% of Jerusalem's population, only 10% of the city's budget is allocated towards East Jerusalem. She wants to give them a better water system, more paved roads, and a more efficient garbage collection. But to do all this, Al-Hut says, we need to have one Arab representative inside the municipal council who can advocate for all of us. But Al-Hut knows that perhaps the biggest obstacle she's up against is her own electorate. If people really want to boycott the municipality, they might as well not pay their taxes, she says. At least you should get something for your taxes. Al-Hut says things have gotten significantly worse here since the October 7th Hamas attacks against Israel and subsequent war in Gaza. So, she says, this is an especially important time for Palestinians to have a representative. So many people have lost their jobs. People are out of work. They're struggling, she says. Back at the bookshop, I ask Ahmad Muna what he thinks of Al-Hut's campaign, to which he says, she's a great candidate. But a great candidate isn't enough to stop what he sees as a corrupt system.
Not because she doesn't want to, but because the system will not allow it.
It's not about trust in the candidate, he says. It's about distrust in a system that has been failing Palestinians in East Jerusalem for more than half a century. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Jerusalem.
Deserts and beaches cover more than one-fifth of the surface of the earth, so it's hard to even fathom running out of sand. But that is what's happening, at least with the most useful type, the tiny fraction of the earth's sand that's suitable for making concrete. Criminals are cashing in on the shortage. They're ripping up ecosystems and dredging rivers to sell off high-grade sand. Researcher Abdelkader Abdelrahman has taken some risks to expose the illicit sand trade.
Between 40 and 50 billion tons of sand is extracted globally every year. It is estimated that half of the sand used in construction is illegally mined.
Wow. And I hadn't realized that sand from the desert isn't as good for building because the grains are round. River and coastal sand apparently has more angular grains, which is better for keeping concrete together. Where is most of this illegally mined construction-grade sand going?
A lot of sand, and huge amount of sand is illegally extracted in India, in Indonesia. In Indonesia, many islands are slowly disappearing due to the illegal sand extraction.
And where is the sand going? If a lot of it is mined in the places you've mentioned, where is it being sold to?
It's sold to construction companies. It also goes to Spain, to Portugal. Some of it goes to the United Arab Emirates. For instance, the palm tree island in off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, a lot of sand that has been used there was imported from places like Morocco.
You've worked on the ground in Morocco in a city called Kenitra, driving to these illegal sand mining sites. This is described at some length in a recent Scientific American article. What was that like?
It was astonishing. It wasn't safe. It goes beyond what we can imagine once we're there. I mean, we see real lunar-like landscapes. Mm-hmm. Different places are disfigured. There's no more way for tourism to be established in different places, and this goes along for kilometers. You mentioned Kenitra, but this is not the only place. I mean, in the south, in Agadir, in the northeast, around Saidiya or Asila, all those places have been deeply affected by sand trafficking.
You mentioned it's like a lunar landscape. Can you tell me what it looked like peering down on these mining sites along the beach in Morocco? Was it a lot of trucks and backhoes, things like that?
Many, many trucks. Daytime, nighttime, those trucks that would be full of sand travel from one point to the other without any fear of being arrested by police forces.
So I understand that it's criminal organizations that are doing this mining. How risky was it, or is it, reporting on this?
It is risky. There's always some kind of civil servants that are working with those criminals, being basically accomplices. And they would do anything to prevent anyone like me to try to investigate, to get too close to those mining sites. This is what happened to me and to those Moroccans who took the risk to travel with me in those different places like Asila, like Kenitra or Medea.
Right. So there's official support for some of this illegal mining. What exactly happened to you when you were stopped there?
We wanted to get to a site that we knew was illegally mined in the small town near near Kenitra, a town called Medea. And we were met by some police force who basically told us to go back from where we were coming. Basically, he prevented us from entering the site.
Finally, demand for high-grade sand seems to be skyrocketing. One study suggests that the world could run out of construction-grade sand by 2050. Is there a solution to stop the illegal mining of sand?
They need to look at alternatives to sand mining. There are different technology that allows construction to be done with old sand that has been recycled. Another way is perhaps to avoid building new houses when old houses can simply be refurbished and upgraded, for instance. And this is one way to prevent more sand to be extracted.
Abdelkader Abdelrahman is a security investigator. He was speaking with us about illegal sand mining around the world, particularly in Morocco.
And now a few news updates on the war in Ukraine.
Expanding NATO was a reaction to Russia's war in Ukraine, and Sweden has just won unanimous support to join NATO. Hungary's parliament today voted to allow Sweden to enter the security alliance, removing the final roadblock after a year and a half of delays. Finland has also been brought into the alliance since the war started.
The explosions that damaged the Nord Stream gas pipelines in 2022 were deliberate sabotage, says Denmark. But investigators there don't have enough evidence to make a criminal case. Denmark closed its investigation today into the underwater attack on the Russian pipelines that were built to carry natural gas to Germany. Swedish officials closed their inquiry earlier this month and handed their evidence over to Germany, which now has the only investigation that remains open.
And in a rare disclosure, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says 31,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in the past 2 years. In addition, tens of thousands of civilians have also been killed in occupied areas of Ukraine, he said. The number of Russian combatants killed in action is much harder to pin down. The Russian Defense Ministry says just over 6,000 Russian soldiers have been killed. The independent Russian news outlet Mediazona says that number is closer to 75,000.
Follow our ongoing coverage of the war in Ukraine at theworld.org or listen wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
Chiakete Brown is a singer whose family lineage is never far from mine. His father is from Liberia, his mother from the southern U.S. Brown was raised near Washington, D.C., where he's now a fixture of the city's music scene. He shared his story with Macleet Hedero for the project Movement, stories all about music and migration.
Can you tell us the story of your name?
The story of my name. So, Chie in the Liberian Kru dialect represents ownership. Kete means to split. So Chie Kete together means the one that can break unbreakable things in two. Heavy name. I don't know why my dad, I don't know what that was all about. That's what it means.
And do you think that he wanted you to break unbreakable things?
Yeah, I think our immigrant parents, they always want to bestow some type of prophecy onto their children. You're going to be like our Moses, because they want, you know, the best for their children. And I've done things where it felt like odds were stacked completely against me, and I've overcome it.
Growing up, Chiquete was kind of a child prodigy. He played drums in the West African church where his father was a pastor. And he also learned to cook fried chicken skin from his southern grandma on his mom's side of the family. He was full of energy and life, but one day when he was 9 years old, he didn't feel right. At first, his parents thought he was just trying to play hooky.
Then the next day, I'd get up and watch cartoons or whatever, got up, collapsed in the hallway. I can't move. I'm like freaking out. Parents come upstairs. They're like, okay, that's definitely strange.
So they went to the doctor. The doctor ran some tests. The family left, but then the doctor called them.
I found something, and you need to rush him to the ER, like, right now. You're racing against the clock at this point.
The doctor had found a rare autoimmune disorder
called Guillain-Barré syndrome. So pretty much what was happening, I had like a common cold, and your white blood cells supposed to fight off the common cold.
Yes.
But they continue to fight, and they were actually eating my nerve endings, causing me to be a paraplegic. Like if you took a spoon and just like scraped it against my hand, I couldn't feel it. I was on track to die. I was on track to be a vegetable.
Wow. And you were 9 years old?
9 years old, 1999.
The paralysis was inching up his body, from his feet and hands to his chest, neck, and head. But Chiquete, remember, came from a church household. They were not about to just sit back and see what the doctors would do.
You got the southern side that's coming through, and it's real tactile. So put the hands on your forehead. Oh, Lord, bless him all. Say when they're shaking, you sitting there, I'm sitting there paralyzed, just in bed. And then you get the same thing on my dad's side. It's just louder, and you just don't know what they're saying. And it's just all kinds of screams and chants and stomping and just like clapping and just chaos.
Love chaos.
But true to the Chiquete name, the person that like, if anybody's going to get through this, it's going to be the one that can get through something that's unbeatable.
And what was the turning point?
The turning point was it stopped in my eyes and it just went back down.
So what was it like to learn to play music again after that?
So it was frustrating coming back because the doctor's orders were, okay, you can go back and do these things, but slowly and don't overexert yourself.
Okay.
That was the one rule. So from there, I start to lean more into the singing. We had like a choir leader that wanted to give me like a solo. So, oh yeah, you had like a miracle. So you got to... We're going to give you the solo,
yes.
And that's going to be like your testimony song. So you taught me this song. And from there I learned, oh, I can sing like a soloist. I didn't know that.
If you've seen Chiquete play around town at Pie Shop or Union Stage, you know he can definitely sing. And when he performs, he still carries the memory of that brush with death. For him, it's a reminder.
If you're going to do something, do it in a way that will echo throughout time. And when your grandson, five grandsons down. Oh yeah, Chiquete. You had a great grandfather, Chiquete, and he was a musician and he was a chef. And he comes from his father's side that came here from Liberia. And his great grandfather was a warrior. And his mom is from the South and they can cook and everything. And so now you can go and do these things.
Wow.
That echo and eternity thing is really big for me. So like I think I'm more than afraid of dying. I'm afraid of dying not having done all that I'm supposed to do or all that I could do.
That's Chiquete Brown. The song is Keep Growing. Movement is produced by Ian Koss and supported by the National Geographic Society and the Mellon Foundation. Listening to the world.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the UK, 1984 was a big year in labor history. Coal mines were closing across the country, and miners were out of work on the picket line and hurting. In South Wales, which is literally built on top of coal, help came from an unexpected place, Ukraine.
Ukrainian miners chipped in money to help support their Welsh counterparts back in 84. Now, 40 years later, Welsh miners are returning the favor as Ukraine enters year three since Russia's full-scale invasion. Mick Antonov is a member of Welsh Parliament who traveled to Ukraine on an aid mission with members of the National Mining Union from South Wales. He has just returned from his ninth visit to Ukraine and told me about the purpose of the trip.
We've been over a number of times, and what we're doing is taking vehicles, 4x4 vehicles, which are much in demand by the Ukrainian army. We also fill them with warm weather clothing, military clothing, night vision equipment, medical equipment, protective equipment, body armor sometimes, and so on. The thing we're really being asked for at the moment, though, are drones. You know, there's obviously a shortage of ammunition at the moment. That's having an impact. So they're saying, get us drones, just get us as many drones as you can, ideally thermal drones. And what we decided this year was that this particular trip was going to be to mark the 40th anniversary of the miners' strike, something which still has massive implications on South Wales and on the community where I live. We take them straight to the miners' union because they have so many members that are fighting on the front line at this moment in time. And we know that the vehicles then go straight to the front line, places like Bakhmut, Kharkiv, Avdiivka, and we know it gets straight to them because they send us photos and videos of the receipt of it, which we've just received.
I mean, that is serious commitment. Can you help us understand why it was so meaningful, apparently, that Ukrainian miners helped out in 1984, and now you're returning this favor?
Well, I remember 1984 well. I was a sort of young lawyer representing the miners' union, so I was traveling around the police stations. About 12,000 miners were arrested during that strike during the year. And of course, the government cut off all support to families. So many families were going hungry, so they were dependent on food. So the Ukrainian miners collected money and they collected food, and a lot of it was transported to South Wales. I remember being there when one of the lorries opened and they had these tins of what were called sprotte, they're like pickled sprats. I don't think they went down too well, but I think the gesture was very appreciated. But the miners were dependent on that food.
I mean, Welsh miners, Ukrainian miners, you are united through your work in the mines. What does that mean, though, fundamentally, like to be brothers in the mines? What experience do you share that creates that bond?
They work underground, they work in the dark, they do dangerous work, they are at risk of disease and injury and loss of life. There is a common bond between miners all over the world. There may be cultural differences, there may be language differences, but at the end of the day, coal miners are coal miners.
Yeah, you make a really good point there, Mick. I mean, whether you're in a mine or fighting a war, both jobs, dangerous work. Do you think that might give Ukrainian miners on the front line some kind of special motivation as they fight the Russian army?
What interested me is that when I visited Pavlograd, I mean, I speak Ukrainian, I don't speak Russian. They are nearly all Russian speakers in the Pavlograd area, but you've never met more patriotic Ukrainians. And when you tell them, well, hang on a sec, Putin says that this war is about protected Russian speakers, they burst out laughing. You know, they are Russian speakers. They are the Russian-speaking Ukrainians.
You kind of tipped to it there, Mick. Some of your family is Ukrainian, right? How has the war affected you personally?
So I've got my cousin who's on the front line at the moment. I met him in the summer. I was very pleased to, and I hope to meet him again in a month's time when I go over to Ukraine. I've got, you know, other family members. We've lost my one cousin. Her husband was a helicopter pilot shot down by a Russian rocket.
Yeah, so very intimate connections you have to the war. Since these trips that you've taken, I mean, what reflections have you had and what do you take away from all of this?
What I noticed quite interesting when I was in Kyiv was whenever we sort of stopped to look around to see where we're going, people come and say, can we help you? You know, is anything? That never happened before. I think there was almost like a bond of solidarity with people where, you know, people know they have to help one another. They have to support one another, whether it means getting into one of the air raid shelters when the sirens go off or whether it means helping when refugees come and people have to be supported.
Mick Antoniv is a member of the Welsh Parliament representing Pontypridd. He and members of the National Mining Union from South Wales just returned from an aid visit to Ukraine supporting Ukrainian mine workers who are now on the front lines. Carolyn, a question for you. Do you think being a friend to someone means you have to always have their back?
Yeah, I think that's always the goal. You always there for each other. That's what being a good friend is. But I guess we're all human and we fail sometimes.
Exactly, which is why I was drawn to this new track by Welsh singer-songwriter Gruff Rhys. We've had him on the show before, and he's out with a new album featuring this song, Bad Friend.
Though I can't promise you every hour of every day, I need to feed the kids and take them to the park to play. They say it's impossible to be everything for everyone. Your back from your panic attacks, and though I'm a bad friend, yes, I've been a really bad slug friend. Just know I'm bleeding, and that I'll be there at the end.
When Gruff Rhys sings about being a bad friend, he says it's his apology for all the times he's not been there for his friends and family.
Unconditional friendship is my thing, and it's my notes of thanks for the unconditional friendship my friends have shown me and that I try and return.
Rhys offers this example. I know I can relate to it.
I have a terrible relationship with timekeeping. I'm a bad friend of timekeeping.
Oh, so he's that one friend who is always 20 minutes late, but you just have to learn how to deal with it.
If everyone in the world was a bad friend rather than an enemy, maybe the world would be a better place.
And though I'm a bad friend, yes, I'm a really bad slang friend. Just know I'm well-meaning, and that I'll be there at the end. Well, yes, I'm a bad friend, but maybe bad friends are still friends. I'm better than an enemy, and I will be there at the end.
Gruff Rhys' song, Bad Friend, is on his new album, Sadness Sets Me Free, out now.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks, as always, for listening.
You know I'm as reliable as asking a seal to deliver the
PRX.